Hello and welcome to Android Developers Backstage, the podcast. I'm Chet Haas from the Android UI Toolkit team.
I'm Tor Norby from the Android Tools team, and we have two guests today. Let's start with you.
It's like I lost the coin flip. I'm Anwar Galoom, Director of Engineering in Android Platform.
Anwar, we should point out, is a repeat guest. We had him on one podcast that turned into two in the past, Garbage Collection. And
I'm Brian Karlstrom. I'm a leader of the Android Runtime and Tools team on the Android Platform team.
That must mean that today we're going to talk about art and language and runtime stuff. So we should point out that we are recording this as the preview release is going out for N. So we'll be talking about the new stuff in that release. Let's dive in. Art, what's new? Lots of stuff.
So lots of stuff. I mean, I don't know if we want to just get the quick overview and then we can dive into things later.
Yeah, let's start with a quick overview.
An agenda slide? Sure.
Sure. Okay. Well, I mean, I can't. Right. If I just I'll know when it'll ever end. So I think the biggest thing that we're doing in Android Runtime for N is the new JIT. So we're going back to the history, you know, Dalvik had started as an interpreter. It moved into having a JIT. But one of the big changes we went to art is we went to doing ahead of time compilation for most of the code in your application, which had positives in terms of performance and battery life and things like that. And sort of dirty memory was reduced in the processes. But it does have come with a cost of space and also just time in terms of installation time and post OTA processing time. So
I love the dialogue that says optimizing.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, yes. Hopefully that will not be a problem anymore. So. What we're doing now is we're going to, at installation time, we just do some basic extraction of the code so we can interpret it quickly and we get running with a newer, fast interpreter that's new in N for art. And then from there, we go to profile-based JIT. And I think what's different than the old system and what other systems that people are familiar with is that we remember the profile information about what was hot in the application, and then we save that for later. And so when your device is idle and charging overnight, we will go and then do that ahead of time compilation, but only of the parts of the application that were hot.
So it's ahead of time after. Time.
Right. It's ahead of time in terms of before the app is running like the next day.
I used to call it after the fact.
Yeah, after the fact compilation.
Still using the AOT term.
Lazy AOT or like behind the time, ahead of time.
Right.
Well, this means that it's never going to be doing the compilation during app run. It's just going to be recording
because the jitting, it is
jitting,
compile
sure.
hot methods during the app run.
Is that the same compilation as the after-the-fact compilation? There's no like deeper level of optimization that it's doing at that point. It's the exact
right same. Now, we haven't really tuned it, but right now it's basically doing the same thing. I think the differences are when you are running in the live process, you can actually do a few extra optimizations that you can't necessarily do ahead of time. But I think what you can do ahead of time – sorry, ahead of time is weird because you're saying it's after-the-fact ahead of time. But you can choose to do more things because you're not – like the user isn't waiting to run the app.
Yep.
So you can do enable more and deeper optimizations.
But that – post-fact compilation, is that doing the entire app as we did prior to N, or is that still sort of focusing on the hotspots in the app?
No, it definitely is focusing on the hotspots that we learned from the profiler.
Okay.
And then, so that kind of goes along with, get better performance, and you kind of keep the battery life benefits because we're not jitting all the time, but it comes with reduced storage costs. And I think right now, it's hard to have firm numbers because we're still tuning things, but I mean, it's like half the storage cost at the very least.
So you don't have the entire APK sort of pre-compiled sitting there, but you have these chunks that you pull out. Right. So when the runtime is going to access a method that we know has been pre-compiled, then you'll go out to the cache and grab it.
Right. And so I mean, I guess when you restart up the app that next day after it's been compiled, it will map in that ahead of time compiled code and use that as the basis for where it starts. But it actually can still continue to JIT on top of that. So if today you use a different part of the app than you did sort of over the last week or two, we will learn, here's the new parts, we'll JIT those, and then we'll remember that profile information. And then on the next night, in idle maintenance mode, we will go ahead and then re-optimize it with the additional information that we've learned.
Oh, so it's, I see. So it's continuously optimizing the apps based on your usage patterns.
Right.
So it's truly hybrid JIT AOT, continuously.
And I think the part I was missing is that the jitting is compiling in the process, but that's not persisted, right?
That's
so that's sort of just on the fly. And so that's the one at night that is going in and saying, okay, we're going to store the code here.
So actually, we can use the same acronym. So AOT is no longer ahead of time. It's all of the time.
Yes.
We're continually compiling and optimizing.
Yeah.
Okay, so what is running for the chunks that are not optimized? Does that mean So you launch the APK, we have a certain amount that is precompiled, and then we're running interpreter for the in-between
right.
parts?
So if you imagine if you do a fresh Play Store install, nothing will be compiled, and so we'll just run our new fast interpreter. So that's sort of a new feature. So hopefully the interpreter performance will be generally acceptable for most people, for most applications, for most people, and then any time there's hotspots, then we'll JIT it and then kind of in a cycle there day over day, like kind of learning what is important for the app to be compiled and what's not.
Do you have benchmarks for the new JIT for typical apps?
With you? Can you project on the far wall over there?
Yes. And so you can see here this wonderful graph that we put together.
Can you use the laser pointer?
So we have some benchmarks and things like that. I don't have all the numbers off the top of my head. So generally speaking, I think the bigger impact, because we were AOTing before and now we're JITting, like there shouldn't be that much difference in the code. That really comes to a second sort of topic we could get into. Which is what new optimizations are we doing in the compiler overall this release to sort of improve the code performance.
But that's really that sounds interesting.
Excellent segue. I also want to hear about the interpreter as well. And Anwar wants to get a word in there.
Yeah, I think it was some other topic.
Can I get a word?
No. So one of the things in sort of the history of Art and Dalvik that Brian didn't mention, out of modesty, I'm sure, is the fact that we launched a new compiler last year in M. And that was the basis for the JIT and the basis for all these optimizations he's about to describe. So in the last few years, actually, we've been continually improving ART from release to release. I don't think, so L, M, and now N will have made pretty major changes. So optimizing compiler landed, I don't think most people noticed it. It was a little bit slower because it was doing more, but...
What did you mean by optimized then?
It's a completely new... That's what we meant by optimizing. We were really optimizing. So that's the foundation for the JIT, and actually... enables us to do a lot of these optimizations, not just the fact that we're doing JIT and have more time, but we have this kind of modern
better platform to build on.
This is a dumb question. This is compiling from what to what?
Compiling from DEX bytecode to native code.
I see.
So ARM 64, x86, x86 64, whatever the target instruction set is on the device.
Okay. Got it.
So we can talk more about what optimizations we're doing. I think one of the biggest things is not just new optimizations, but tuning the existing optimizations. So when we're doing JIT or even ahead of time overnight, when we're only compiling a small part of the app, we can actually do a lot deeper inlining. A lot of what we were limited by when we were trying to AOT the whole app is it took a long time to install apps, but that was actually pretty fast compared to where we were at the even in the Dalvik sort of used to do pre-verification and bytecode optimization. We kind of tried to keep that within a certain bound. And so we did minimal inlining just to sort of make sure we didn't spend a lot of time during the installation phase. So one thing we've done is really turn on deeper inlining, multiple levels of inlining, so that things where you have helper functions that are all calling each other and sort of now they can all be combined into one larger function so optimization can happen over a larger surface area. Other improvements we made were we had, even in the optimizing compiler in M, we had what's called bounds check elimination. So we tried to statically or have with some dynamic checks prove that you're in a loop over an array or something, you're not going to go out of bounds. And so what we've done improvements there is there are more cases that we can cover now where, maybe we have to do some extra pre-checks. And if we fail any of the checks, this code really is going to go out of bounds, then we can punt to the interpreter and give you a precise exception semantics of showing you exactly where in the loop or what iteration you would have thrown the exception where. So we have just additional optimizations around bounds check elimination. The new major sort of optimization is load store elimination. So basically just, again, optimizing the code, removing redundant loads and stores so that we just make the overall optimized code smaller. And basically smaller code typically has better performance, right?
This is where you go and store into a register and then you read it back later. And so we figure we don't need to go through that intermediate.
Right.
Okay.
Right. So that's sort of one of the major things. And I guess there's just more general loop optimizations. I mean, some of this really impacts the framework code a lot more. And actually that's one thing I was going to mention about AOT versus JIT and hybrid kind of things is that the platform itself, the framework's code, is still ahead of time compiled. So when you're in your context of your app, like when you're starting up and all the framework code and view code is running, that's all ahead of time compiled. You're not JITting that in your process. And that is a big difference from Dalvik because they were JITting across both sort of the boot class path, as we think of it, and the application's code.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask about the method level optimizations too. Someone was explaining that the difference between Dalvik optimization potential and ART optimization potential to some extent, comes down to the fact that you can see entire methods. Like you were saying, like inlining can be much more aggressive because you can have these nested hierarchies of inlining going on. And at Dalvik, it was, forgive me if I'm using the term wrong, trace level optimizations, right? So you didn't actually know the context of an entire method, or certainly not nested methods. Can you explain the difference between these?
Right. So Dalvik was trying to work. I mean, the Dalvik JIT was sort of designed at a time, you know, it was kind of at the Eclair time. It shipped in Froyo, but it was, you know, memory was much scarcer then, and it was trying to use like 100K or less for its code cache. So you could only compile very small pieces of even not even methods, but like, you know, hot loops or small little code paths that were hot. Which really, you know, yes, it had some inlining. It could like inline simple like accessors because that kind of might fit inside the scope of a trace, but it really couldn't do sort of broader inline a lot of things and then sort of do. We don't have full interprocedural optimizations in ART yet, but like the fact that we can do deep inline kind of lets us do interprocedural optimizations where you can see that there's a collection of functions that are, you can all be inlined and you can optimize across that much larger sort of kind of window.
Right. Yeah, because I remember conversations with the Dalvik team in years and releases past where they all knew the optimizations that people wanted, but with the platform that they had, they really couldn't do that. It really took an entirely new platform. It wasn't like an incremental improvement on Dalvik because Dalvik just had constraints that you could not go beyond.
Well, I think it's not just that Dalvik had constraints, but it's that the devices of the time, I mean, were more constrained. And like we still try to, I mean, we still support what we call a lower-end device or a Svelte device or whatever we want to call it now. But those are still far greater in terms of capacity and resources than even the sort of high-end phones, I think, were at the in the days of Dalvik when the original JIT was being designed.
Dalvik was like, to me, I think of Dalvik, I think of it as being sort of the epitome of like this sort of really well-optimized system for the device of its day, right? Like you couldn't get that, you couldn't optimize it to be any faster in terms of the trade-off of compile time and memory usage and so on versus code performance. I think we got to a point though where there was more and more code application logic, you know, happening in Java, not just in the cloud in the back end or in native code, where we actually needed more performance. And Dalvik wasn't really designed to do kind of the level of optimization that Brian's talking about. And that's one reason why, you know, when we first did ART, we basically took the Dalvik JIT and adapted it to this new compiler. I mean, with some changes, you know, broader, wider scope of optimization and so on. But, you know, we were kind of hitting the limits of what that compiler could do. So optimizing compiler is really a way of getting out of that to more of this modern compiler infrastructure where we could do this really aggressive optimization that we want to do, like all the things you guys wanted.
Yep. Yay.
And more in the future.
So I know that, you know, we many years ago posted these recommendations for developers for like micro optimizations, you know, like, hey, you should, for example, try to, you know, access fields directly. Don't call getters and setters. Right? I don't remember all the details.
Or
right?
Also put final, like all your local variables, like within a method. You know, people are marking those final for reasons that elude me. Yeah. How much of those carry over?
Yeah. So I'm wondering which ones of those have potentially changed with this. Are there any you would still recommend people do or things that are not needed anymore? Or are there some that you could do that would then allow the compiler to go, oh, now it's so simple that I can enable this optimization?
So I think I'm always hesitant to give people guidance on this because I feel like most app developers still care about devices that are KitKat and older at this time frame. So I don't want to tell people, well, go do all these optimizations because ART will solve all your problems, and then they have to go run a KitKat and it doesn't do those things yet. So that in mind, I think when people start to in the future target like Lollipop and higher, there are a lot of things where it sort of matters less. So. Like, you know, ART has always done a much better job, like, inlining accessors. So what are the other kind of crazy performance guidance? I remember those things. It's like programming like a C programmer in Java. I remember in earlier days of regular Java, that was something we did as well because before JIT and things like that.
Yep.
So what other – there was a couple you said. I'm trying to think
There's the marking of final.
The final thing. I only think final local variables – I don't even think that would have helped Dalvik. That seems like a total myth because that's just syntactic sugar that's at the Java compiler level. By the time you're in bytecode,
yeah,
that's not even there. So I think final methods do even still help ART. Like saying something is final, we'll know like when we're compiling, like we know which one you're going to call because we see that like even your class or your method is final. We don't, it's just not going to be overridden in a subclass. We can do optimizations around that. So those types of things are still useful.
So that's not something that the compiler could see, whether or not there were any, you know, it can't look at the whole class hierarchy?
Well, so this is the problem. I mean, people doing, so I think most, I don't know, most app developers probably have a single APK with a single DEX file, and, or even if they're using multi-DEX, it kind of is treated as one larger DEX file. And we kind of have that full scope. The problem is some people do use dynamic class loaders. They use DEX class loader, path class loader, and in those cases—
instant run. Yep. Hmm? I just said instant run.
Right.
Yes.
Well, in instant run, they try to make it appear as if it's one unified thing.
Yeah, but we load classes on the fly every time we hit run. But
right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so I guess the problem is when we're optimizing, we can't necessarily make whole program assumptions right now because you could do something different at runtime. And so we had to compile code conservatively. Actually, going to the JIT makes it a little easier because if we do detect at runtime that some compile time assumption we made is totally invalidated because you've done something, you know, unexpected with your class loader, we can fall back to JIT, which is great. Because before, if we fall back to the interpreter, it was more of a performance hit in your app, which sort of just discouraged people from doing these things.
What an excellent segue into the interpreter. So you said faster interpreter. Is this a totally new thing, or we just took out the sleep calls?
So I think when ART, the original ART interpreter was, you know, we were designing for ahead of time compiled system. So the interpreter's primary function was to run for debugging, for Java debugging. So we were so it was never tuned. It was like all portable C++ code, which isn't necessarily the perfect thing if you want to have the fastest execution possible. So we've gone back to having assembly support for each of the sort of primary architectures so that we can do a lot more in custom coded things. And it turns out a lot of the actual individual bytecodes, especially the arithmetic bytecodes that do a lot of what the program does, like those actually, it's similar enough to Dalvik that we reused a lot of that assembly. So it sort of was a relatively low risk thing to do. What's different about it is that just the ART calling conventions are different in terms of how it actually represents the stack. ART is very different from Dalvik in those respects. Dalvik had two separate stacks, one for like the main, what you think of as like the, maybe the P thread or the native stack. And then there was another stack for the Dalvik interpreter that was a separately allocated memory region. And so when you were going back and forth interpreter, it's like you really had two different stacks with Dalvik, whereas ART has one unified stack. So for better locality when you're going in across Java and C frames. And so therefore the calling conventions and assembly and whatever support you need for the interpreter is completely different. So most of the engineering effort was redoing all those pieces with ART in mind.
Does this benefit debugging as well then with the new interpreter being faster? I know that part of the reason why debugging for Android apps is somewhat slow is that it's remote process debugging, right? So and the protocol, I think, at least the one that Android Studio uses, is kind of slow. It keeps asking for, hey, give me all the locals on every step and all that. But on the other hand, if the interpreter is faster, have you measured or do you know if this is making debugging any faster?
So I hate to tell you, but I think when the fast interpreter is meant for when you're running execution, it doesn't support all the hooks you need for debugging. And so we have sort of, and we have an extra layer on top of that when you're doing profiling for the JIT, there's some extra hooks we put on top of that. But likely when you're going to do like single stepping debugging, you're going to go back to the old regular interpreter that gives you precise like debugging semantics.
We did a bunch of work, I thought, in M to make debugging faster. I mean, without rewriting the interpreter, we actually sped things up quite a bit.
Yeah, and I think there was some easy low-hanging fruit we did in M compared to what we did in Lollipop in terms of like when originally you would touch the debugger, you can imagine the simplest thing you could do is run everything in the interpreter. But as soon as you attach the debugger, like that's the safest thing to do. But really, you don't want to do that. You don't want to really go into the interpreter until there's a breakpoint in that. So what we do now, I think in Marshmallow is that we only sort of, we call it like de-optimization, but we, you know, replace like the method's code pointer with an entry point to the interpreter, like for only the things that you're actually going to have breakpoints in and things like that. And so that sort of generally improved the debugging performance in Marshmallow. So I don't think you're going to see great changes there.
Okay.
Instant run will help, of course, too.
Of course.
Because I don't have to restart my app.
That's true.
All right. So I think that kind of covers ART. Then another big area that people would be interested in are language changes. So I don't know if you want to dive in. What's new?
Okay, well, the headline is Java 8 language support. I'll let Brian
Yay.
Get into
Do we have like a laugh track or an applause track we can cue here?
Wait, which
that
one?
That light is there? The headline there Yeah, I mean, the headline features for Java 8 are, you know, Lambda support, default methods, streams, probably a bunch of things I'm forgetting. I'll let Brian get into the specifics of what we're supporting.
Yeah. So I think, to me, Java 8 is really about three things. It's about the language features, which Anwar touched on. It's also about sort of the runtime support for those things. And then finally, it's about sort of the libraries that sort of complement that. So on the language side, it is Lambdas are the biggest thing that obviously people have been asking for. So we'll be doing Lambdas. It requires front-end, these are language changes, so it involves a compiler, front-end compiler, not the ART runtime runtime compilers, but Jack, actually. And Jack is our Java front-end compiler that will be supporting the new language features. It actually supports Lambdas in a backward-compatible way, so if you're using Lambdas basically as just syntactic sugar for replacing anonymous inner classes to make your code more readable, those things will actually still work if you use it on older releases because it's just doing a simple implementation using anonymous inner classes under the hood. So you can think about it in terms of cost and performance. Like, you can use them where you would have used anonymous inner classes. You can use them in your app, actually, if you're using Jack, even back for older non-N releases, and it's sort of a separate kind of syntactical sugar feature.
So there, I should point out, too, that the fact that they're using anonymous inner classes, like, it's basically syntactic sugar, means that it can work on older releases. It also means that there's a performance implication. If you decide that Lambdas are the greatest thing ever and you start using them everywhere where you wouldn't have used anonymous inner classes before, there could be an issue, which is why we're not necessarily folding this into, like, you know, new APIs that we're coming out with, because we don't want to introduce this as a pattern that you have to use throughout your application, right? It's right. More like it's a convenience language feature that, you know, knocks yourself out, but don't expect to use it everywhere without incurring the penalty that you would incur otherwise.
I think we expect most people to use it where they're using anonymous inner classes now anyways. And in general, I think the philosophy of introducing language changes before, you know, modifying the platform to extensively use it or depend on or support it makes sense. Gives us time to sort of soak it. People can use it if they want in their applications. And, it, you know, we can kind of see how it's working and, you know, in the next release optimize it and roll out more extensive support in this case, use of Lambdas in the platform APIs themselves.
Yep. It seems like it'd be ideal for the view stuff, you know, for like on-click handlers and things like that.
Yeah, that's certainly the first thing that occurs to you. All the places where you currently generate one on the fly to, you know, have the callback that you want. But yeah, I'd love to see how people are incorporating it before we basically bake it into the APIs that we live with forever.
So do we use anonymous inner classes on N as well, or do we have something more native
and faster there?
Yeah,
currently we're doing that. So we're not changing the bytecode version. So that, you know, the Dex code can work across both versions.
Okay. And you said that this you have to use Jack for this, right? So the Dex tool, if you're using other Java compilers, they will not – then you would just get Dex files and you have to get from Dex to
– Right. Like, so we currently – there's no support in DX for sort of taking Java class files that have, you know, Lambdas encoded there and converting them to something that's usable right now.
Okay. All right. So you use Jack, and I guess in that case you'd have to use the latest Gradle plugin 2.1 to do this.
Yep.
Okay.
And we are looking in the future at broader class file support. But, yeah.
Okay. But this is how you do it right
for
now.
For the preview release, that's basically Jack is the way to try this thing out.
Yeah. Okay. And how about default methods, similar?
Right. So default methods is less similar. Default methods requires runtime support right now to support them. So although you compile with Jack, it will not let you target older releases.
So this is where you put a method implementation on an interface?
Right, and it's sort of yes, it's great. It's actually a great feature from the framework side because we can finally have interfaces that you can extend and not worry about breaking backward compatibility for apps that don't implement.
Yep. We gave up using interfaces and APIs completely because of this problem, because you basically paint yourself into a corner and you just kick yourself in some future release. So everything becomes an abstract class. But if you have extendable interfaces, it's a little easier to deal with.
Yep. So it seems like it'd be possible to use a compiler trick to support this compatibly, but that's not what we're doing?
Well, that's not what we're doing for N preview. So like I was saying, there's continuing work because Jack is sort of decoupled from the platform from a development point of view. So like support for like maybe we could do importing of Java bytecodes that have Lambdas, or, you know, that we could have default methods implementation that sort of by doing a lot of synthetic code generation. But that's one of those things that will be a trade-off. But we don't have that right now. But that's something that's clearly on the Jack kind of roadmap.
Cool. That's exciting.
Very cool. And what was the
Lambdas,
other?
Default
well, there's,
methods,
you know, there's another thing strings. It's called repeated annotations. Oh, yeah. That's actually one of the language features. It's not that exciting probably unless you're someone who's using building infrastructure that uses annotations.
Yeah, I think it's very exciting. In fact, we ran
you're
into
like
this.
Like a major annotation person.
Yeah. And you know, so for example, we have a support annotation for requiring permissions, right? And that's one of those things where you can imagine you'd like to put multiple of these on there. And currently you can't. So it's kind of hacky right now. There's these.
Well, yeah, you can do it by creating your own
by
containers.
Nesting. Exactly. Yes. But the thing about the nesting is they don't let you do it in an arbitrary way. So you actually have to have different methods for each annotation type. So this is something that I think is going to be really good. And speaking of annotations, do we have the JSR 308 style annotations? You know, the annotations on types. So I can say, for example, I have a list and I want to mark all the elements of the list as nullable.
So type annotations. Is something that's coming in Jack, but it is not there present in the current version. That's one place it's lacking. And so that'll probably be added as a Jack-only feature. And like in a future, we won't have the runtime support. So it'll be great for tools for doing support for tools, but it will not be a runtime accessible thing in N.
Yeah, and I don't know. I'm very biased, right? Because static analysis is sort of where you know all the interesting work is. But it seems like I can't really think of a lot of interesting runtime annotations for.
No, and that's sort of, we kind of made this decision based on the feedback we got from developers and other tool builders and things like that.
This is really about being able to tell you, hey, you know, this collection has something nullable in it, for example.
Yep.
And then the other feature Anwar mentioned was streams.
So that's on the library side. It's not really a language feature.
Yeah, there's a bunch of library side.
So I can skip ahead. I mean, I said language things, runtime things mostly is the default methods work we talked about.
Yeah.
And then the third thing is a little bit of reflection support, too, for some of these new things. There's method is default, like, so you can ask, is this a default method?
Yeah.
But nothing too exciting there. So then it comes to the API. So the biggest things are things that are sort of Lambda related. So, you know, having Java util function, there's the, you know, functional interface class that you can use for annotating, similar to add override. You can say, like, I'm declaring this to be a functional interface. If I ever accidentally add more than one single abstract method, then give me a compiler error. There is repeatable. Obviously, if you're going to have repeatable annotations, you have to have support for repeatable. But streams kind of goes beyond that.
Yeah, streams are something that we've gotten positive developer feedback on, something that they wanted. We weren't prioritizing it for this release. We're thinking more for the O release. But you know, with people wanting to sort of do more functional programming, you know, sort of composing things on lambdas, streams was actually something that they really wanted, right? So a lot
is
of
this where you take sort of one function and you sort of wrap it with another and you sort of pipe them all together, like in Unix with pipes, kind of thing?
Yeah, it's very much like a the styles of functional programming, sort of applicative functional programming, mm-hmm. where you're, you know, sort of applying operators to collections, and you can compose these operators, and the operators can be, you know, kind of folded across it or mapped across the collection. And this lets you sort of really concisely compose a bunch of different operations in different ways, right? Across streams, which streams, you know, you can create a stream out of collections, out of, you know, something that's reading something off of storage. So it's something that uses the expressive power of lambdas, but then, you know, gives you sort of additional expressive power in terms of being able to compose these things to do fairly complex sequences of operations on a collection or an I/O stream or whatever. So it's kind of goes hand in hand. I mean, with the sort of this move to supporting functional programming more in Java, I expect that we'll see more of that in Java 9. I actually haven't looked at the Java 9 language specification.
So are these APIs in the Java Lang namespace, or are they in the Android
Java,
framework, or is it
Java util streams?
Okay.
Is where the bulk of the new things exist. And I'll put a little caveat after his sales job, which is this will not be in developer preview 1.
Yes.
Okay.
But it will be coming soon, and it's something we're doing for N.
Okay. So this will require N then as a min SDK version.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, absolutely.
Right.
Any of the API changes in general, you can assume that.
Yeah.
For the time being, yeah, it's generally been true.
But it's just the chicken egg problem. If we don't put them in, you can never use them. So
I don't know how this is implemented, but I was wondering, would it be possible to put these in support library?
No, not really.
Okay.
It's sort of like, you know, we had for you know, string is empty. We added it eventually. It was Java 6 API. It's annoying for people who are like, oh, I had to target something older that doesn't have string is empty, so I can't use it. But it's really hard. It's a sort of fundamental part of
sure.
the class.
Yeah.
And in the boot class path, it's sort of hard to make.
And the sooner we put it in, the better, obviously.
Yep.
Were there other things in the sort of language or library space? Or there were other features you were talking about?
No, I think there's some more sort of art features, sort of other things we're doing to sort of generally improve the world.
Bring it.
So I don't know where to start. I guess I'll start with the sort of developer tools facing stuff. So memory analysis. So we have always supported sort of collecting HPROF files, like how developers see that is very different than how I see it. So I guess I'm sorry if I don't know the right Android Studio terms, but there's like the memory profiling tools and things like that. Mm-hmm. So we've added support for collecting stack traces for allocation sites. So instead of just seeing like, oh, here's where all this memory is, but who allocated, you can actually get that information about who is allocating, where objects that are leaking are being allocated from. So that really can help you track down leaks.
So it's like runtime, I'm thinking runtime MAT support, essentially, right? Figure out where this thing got allocated.
Well, no, I mean, it's basically MAT support. It's just the files that MAT and there's a thing called HAT, or like all these different tools, like we have our own now called AHAT. But the thing is, those file formats supported like stack traces for allocations, but we never provided that information in the file.
Yeah.
And so now we have the ability to actually provide that information, and we worked with the studio team of their perflib library that kind of builds on top of this to collect this data to help present it.
So does that mean that we're recording? So this was for when you dump a heap, right, of a running app, which you might not have asked for up front to, like, are we collecting all the allocation information at all times?
No, so you have to enable it.
Okay, so you say please track it, and then, okay, got it.
So if you're looking for a leak, you would turn it on, grab your trace, and then you've got like, oh, okay.
Sure.
We actually have, I don't know if we're shipping native leak tracking supports or debug malloc. We're working on that. But anyways, we've had this tool for the native side, oddly enough, before we had the tool for the Java side. And this is part of our effort to sort of, you know, we see sort of Android extending across this range of devices from, you know, 512 megabytes of RAM to 4 gigabytes. I think I saw an Android device that had maybe 6 gigabytes of RAM recently.
Yeah.
Not a multiple of 2.
So we have this huge range of memory footprints that we have to think about. And so our application developers have this huge range of memory footprints they have to think about. So this is part of, you know, kind of our effort to make it easier for developers to optimize their applications for memory usage. And, you know. Leaks happen.
Yeah, and leaks are very bad.
Yes.
Right. And one thing we are doing to try to improve sort of developers' visibility into their memory usage is there's a lot of Java objects that really are represented largely on the native side. And so one of those is bitmaps, right? So if you look at, I mean, when I look at HPROF files or HPROF dumps of average applications, it's almost all bitmaps. Everything else is almost in the noise. So one thing is that those are currently represented as Java byte arrays, and underneath the hood, they're being used by the native side. But a lot of that's not always true now. So the internal framework implementation of these things, sometimes it's natively allocated, sometimes it's Java allocated. And we were kind of concerned if suddenly all these things disappeared from your heap, you would have no kind of concept of where your memory, your real overall application footprint was. And so we have added this thing underneath the hood so that we can actually report these sort of native allocations that are sort of the backing sort of weight of the sort of wrapper Java objects for bitmaps and canvases and similar other drawables, I think, for basically these graphics classes where more of the storage for that memory storage is moving to native, so that when you get your HPROF file, you can actually see and visualize it'll still sort of represent the weight of how big those things are in terms of your overall memory usage.
Yeah, I'm just throwing a small tip. In Android Studio, when you use the heap analyzer and you're looking at your bitmap objects, you can actually right-click on them and say, show me this bitmap, and you can see the image. Because sometimes you have a bunch of icons and it just says bitmap.
Cool.
You don't know what they are. And I used this recently when I was, you know, working on the instant run stuff. So I had all these bitmaps and I couldn't tell what they were. You just right-click and say, oh, that's that icon. That's pretty useful to know.
So it actually renders it as, as an image.
Yeah, it just fetches the actual bitmap from the profile file, and then we use, you know, the right decoder to, you know, look at the file format and render it. It's pretty nice.
Very cool.
Had this in the debugger for a while, so when you're debugging, you can do this. But now we can also do it to, you know, a dead heap.
This is why we have Tor on the show. He has these handy little tips he likes to throw out.
You know.
Okay. Yes?
Yeah, no, there's more stuff.
Yeah, please.
So another thing we're doing, so a lot of larger applications have been. I mentioned class loaders before, and a lot of applications are using multiple class loaders in their application. But one problem with that historically was that we didn't have any class unloading. So if you kind of had your app and tried to modularize it into pieces and like only load parts when you needed to, once it was loaded, it was loaded. And sort of whatever the memory impact and overall sort of, you know, resource utilization, even just in fact that it was using more address space, not 32-bit.
Yeah.
Address space is not necessarily
there's a bunch of metadata associated with these files as we load them as well. So
right.
It just sits there.
So we went ahead and implemented class unloading. So most app developers probably won't benefit from this directly, but the larger apps that are using these things, hopefully we'll be able, once you know you drop all those objects that were referenced and the classes therefore are no longer referenced, then we can drop the class loader and as well, and then garbage collect all of that. In terms of garbage collecting, the resources used for the classes, the files that are, it was an OAT file for the code for that class loader, that can be closed. Like all this stuff can be released now.
Is this automatic? Like we know that the reference is gone and therefore we unload it. So there's no APIs or things
there's
that
no
developers
APIs,
have to do.
It's just if you're using, you know, if you're, and this is, I just want to mention it because if people are like, well, it doesn't matter because it won't get unloaded. So I'll just keep a global, like, I don't know, list of all of my class loaders. It's like, no, you really want to make sure that if you aren't using something anymore, let go of it.
Because that's now a leak, basically.
We will try to unload these things. So a little bit more app impacting for the average app is this new concept called app images. So again, this is a transparent thing, but I want to kind of make people aware of it just because it may affect their app performance. So app image is trying to do for class loading a little bit of what the JIT and AOT, hybrid AOT, is doing sort of just for code execution. So when you're starting up your app, you spend a lot of time just getting your basics, you know, classes going to get your UI on the screen. And every time we do that, we have to load dynamically the class, link it, find like what's a superclass, make sure all the methods and the return type, everything like looks good, and get all those dependencies loaded potentially. And so doing that every time you start your app is part of the cost of starting the app. So what app images are is we snapshot like what do you seem like you're loading at the beginning of your app. And we remember that, and as part of the overnight profiling, we will kind of pre-allocate and initialize like a file that has those classes like and linked as we will have them in memory later. And we store that along with the ahead of time compilation. Then when you start your app the next time, we memory map that in. When you try to load the classes, you go, oh, I already found it. Like basically they look like uninitialized but already resolved classes to the application running, and so that they can get started much faster.
Nice. Do you have any sense of,
So we have numbers for these.
I should point out though, this isn't completely new. We've been doing this for art since the beginning of art for Boot ClassPath.
Okay.
So preloaded classes, a subset of them end up getting pre-initialized.
Well, actually, a superset of them. Well, it's a weird because
there's other stuff in the application code as well.
It's a subset of the preloaded classes, but then additional classes that are transitively reached. So
okay. So the new thing here is that app developers get the same thing.
Yep.
Right. And it should be an automatic thing. But it should. It does mean, I think this is actually a place where we're going to spend a lot more time. This is part of it, but even more in the written communication about educating developers about the different modes their app might run in and how it can impact performance. So just to go back, I mean, this goes with the JIT as well. Like when you first install, we're going to interpret in JIT and you're not going to have an app image, right? And so it's going to be a different experience of like if it had been profiled and you had like the startup time sort of the initial classes sort of able to be preloaded. So that'll be a different experience. So we are adding some like ADB shell PM commands to help you sort of like simulate these different things so you can reproduce an issue. It's like, oh, if it only is cold start startup time when you first install it versus what is the startup time like after a day. And to sort of and also tools for you if you're trying to measure these things, like, well, crap, now I don't want to uninstall and reinstall the app just to simulate these different things, that you can kind of reset the state, clear the profile and start over kind of things. So we are adding some more kind of developer commands through ADB shell to simulate this, and we are going to document those. Some of those I think are already going to be in some of the preview documentation. There'll be some overview of this.
You know, we want to think about that for it's off the cuff here. You know, we might want to think about that for Android Studio as well. Maybe putting in some hooks to reset the state on the device.
Right. I mean, it should be doable.
Okay.
All right. What else we got? It's like infinite list here.
No, I don't know if I had too much else.
Well, that's, I mean, we don't have to get into it, but, you know, there was something about ICU 2 now, right? So we are bundling ICU, so now it's available to developers as opposed to just being an implementation artifact inside of Android?
Right. That's, I think, hopefully going to be a big impact. So the historical Java and even Android APIs around internationalization and localization have not always been great. And I know a lot of developers, especially on the server side, like just have always used ICU for J as like, this is what we use. Cause often even Android and other people have been using ICU for J underneath the hood to implement these other classes. So why not just expose it directly? So that's what we were doing in N. In M, we had actually already included it and we were using it to sort of drive the platform implementations of things. But now we're making a public API. And I think the hard thing here has been to pick the right subset of ICU, because ICU is a large, both ICU, there's a C, ICU for C and ICU for J for Java. They are very large and complex APIs, and the needs of sort of localization and internationalization, it evolves over time. And so they have what they consider a stable subset. And so we've kind of worked to get that stable subset and expose it, because once we make it an Android API,
that's it.
We're kind of stuck with it indefinitely, yeah. Even if we regret it later.
Yeah. So but yeah, that's how API.
There's always going to be some regrets. That's what that deprecate is for, right? So, so we are going to expose it and that should be there, and that should hopefully let people directly just use that without having to worry about.
And I think the nice thing about that is that given that it's also available as a third-party library, you could today add it as a dependency in your app, even if you're using Minix to give version 8 or 10 or whatever. And in the future, it'll be easy for you to just drop it. And
The one thing I'll warn you about is that the biggest problem with doing that, and a lot of people do that, is that the size of the ICU data is something you really want to have the platform providing to you and not have to, because it's 10 or 20, I don't know, megabytes of just stuff. And so apps that really focus on these things, I think, I mean, even professional developers today are already including if they really have to have the absolute best data, but it's pretty rare. Usually,
and I wonder if we couldn't maybe do some tool support where we, you know, strip down the data to only the locales you care about, because I know that it has hundreds and hundreds of locales. I think it even supports Klingon. There's a bunch of stuff in there.
You're implying we don't want Klingon?
Is that one of our supported platforms?
I
apologize.
Are you discriminating against Klingon? It's one of Google's top languages, I think, for... The next billion users? I don't know.
It's easier to get to 10 billion that way.
Excellent. So my takeaway for the whole conversation, whether it's Java 8 or Klingon or ICU for J, is that language is hard. I think that's what I've learned today. Tor, do you have any takeaways?
Yeah. No, I think that's probably true.
All right.
Things are better.
Yeah.
Things are getting better always.
Always. Excellent. So people should be able to get preview release and start building with this and playing with
Most of the stuff we were talking about.
Yes. Excellent. So unless we pulled it in the meantime, by the time we post this podcast, please go get the bits. Anything else to add?
So I'd encourage developers to find and file bugs, please. We've gotten some of our best feedback from the developer community and enthusiast community. I think we'll have a release targeting enthusiasts and consumers, a preview a little bit further down the line. But anyone who does end up using this, please file bugs.
That's why we're doing a preview now, as opposed to a massive rollout with marketing at I/O, right? Is that we really, really want to get people started now.
Yeah, it's why we started in Lollipop. And I would say that was a beta for us of actually shipping a preview, because we were also really churning the platform at the same time we got the preview out. But it was sort of testing the wheels of how would we do this for real. And I think we did better in M and hopefully even better in N about getting it out early enough and stable enough where people could use it, send us the feedback, and we can incorporate that into the full release.
And I think that's one thing we really did better, and that's where we've gotten better, is that in Lollipop we didn't process the feedback as well. Marshmallow, we got a lot. The feedback was a lot more. The feedback was heard internally, and we really listened to it. And I think we're going to be, hopefully, getting a lot. We'll be able to respond to that feedback in the end as well.
Yeah, I don't know if people realize that we actually watch all the feedback. Like there was this website when we shipped art as a preview in KitKat. People had websites that documented what things weren't and were and weren't compatible with art, and we actually used that because it had like apps that weren't on our top, you know, whatever 10,000 list that we were, you know, aggressively testing. You know, we used that to sort of, you know. Close gaps in our coverage, basically.
Yeah. Just to be clear, we prefer bug reports.
Yes, absolutely. Yes.
But if you do blog, make sure you use the following keywords.
Yes.
Actually,
hashtag art needs help. Help us.
Yeah, actually, I'd like to do a PSA, because this happens when we do previews, right? Is that people complain about the tools. They say, hey, so I made this preview build and it won't run on my phone. Why does it say, you know, incorrect target SDK version or whatever? And the reason for this is that when you build with a preview platform, we set, whether you want to or not, we set the Minix version and the target SDK version to the code name of the platform. That's just what we do. And that means that it can only be installed on that platform. You know, with N, you can only run it on the N emulator image. And if you try to run it on your personal phone, it just won't work. And the reason for that is that we're basically forcing this to prevent the case where you put this app on the store, because the store will not let you upload a main SDK version of N preview. Because we don't want that. Basically, you put that app in the store, it gets a million users, and then we change an API, because, you know, that's the whole point of preview.
Yep.
And then the app crashes. So that's the whole point of this. And so please don't file bugs on this. We know it's a little maybe not obvious when you get the compilation error message, but that is very, very deliberate on our part. So, end of PSA.
Yep. All right. Got any PSAs, Brian?
No, nothing today.
All right.
Onward.
Nope. Yep. Said my spiel.
All set. Thanks a lot.